perception that the Americans come in, do what they want, you know, remove who they want, you know, put into power who they want, obviously via their primary sort of go-between, which is the army. And that's why I think you have this groundswell of opinion, which is both anti-domestic elite and also anti-foreign elite. And, you know, for what it's worth, this is something that we have to pay attention to. It's another matter altogether that, you know, Pakistan, like so many other countries, is missing a progressive left that can tap into that sentiment. And that's why I think you have strong men like Khan acquiring so much popularity.
And Asim, we just have a minute, but is it your sense, of course, PTI supporters, Imran Khan's party supporters, believe this about him, but was he really an anti-imperial president, a prime minister?
Look, I mean, you know, from our perspective, to be anti-American or to be anti-Western is different from being anti-imperialist. And you asked earlier about what he did in power. I mean, in practice, you know, there were very few policy steps to change Pakistan's sort of foreign policy regime, its larger militarized sort of policy matrix. So, you know, I think for us, the challenge for us on the left is how do we, you know, take this burgeoning sentiment amongst a young population and deepen it and in more progressive directions. Of course, that's a hard task, but I don't see any other way for us to break this cycle between a liberal center that keeps creating, paving the way for, you know, far right figures to become popular and come to power.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321.
Tune in to KBOO's International Women's Day celebration, kicking off on Thursday, March 7th at 8 p.m. with Ears to the Streets of Portland, and wrapping up with a special Women's Day edition of Music from the Truvine on Saturday morning. That's right, this year's celebration will include a full 40 hours of women-centered programming. Again, that's KBOO's International Women's Day special programming, starting at 8 p.m. on Thursday, March 7th, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Catch the full special programming lineup at kboo.fm/IWD.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, another emergency landing at PDX, the second one involving an Alaska Airlines Boeing jet this year. Multnomah County's chair says the 90-day fentanyl emergency is producing results. And a Portland State University expert on what could work to help the houseless community and create more affordable housing. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Last night, an Alaska Airlines Boeing jet had to make an emergency landing at PDX. The jet took off from Portland, then its crew called for the emergency landing because of fumes detected in the cabin. This is the second incident requiring an emergency landing involving an Alaska Boeing jet at Portland's airport this year. In January, another flight returned to PDX after a door panel blew out the side of the Boeing aircraft. On Capitol Hill, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, told U.S. senators that it's been a struggle to get information from Boeing about that incident.
There are a number of parties to the investigation. Some parties have been very cooperative, for example, the Federal Aviation Administration. Boeing has not provided us with the documents and information that we have requested numerous times over the past few months, specifically with respect to opening, closing, and removal of the door and the team that does that work at the Renton facility.
Are you telling us, even 2 months later, you still do not know who actually opened the door plug?
That's correct, Senator. We don't know, and it's not for lack of trying. It's not unusual that we don't get information immediately in an investigation. I can point to numerous investigations where this occurs, and it takes months and months to get information. But for this one, it's 2 months later. We know for a fact that there is a team that deals with the doors in Renton. There's an entire team of 25 people and a manager. The manager has been out on medical leave. We've not been able to interview that individual. We've asked for the names of the other 25 people, have not received the names. We've asked for the records with respect to what occurred. We've asked for what shift it occurred on. We think we know what days the work occurred on, but that's only because of our investigators' work looking at pictures and emails to try to get to the bottom of that information. We don't have the records. We don't have the names of the 25 people that is in charge of doing that work in that facility. It's absurd that 2 months later, we don't have that. Our investigators right now are at the Renton facility, and they are conducting interviews from, those started on Sunday, and they will continue for the rest of the week. One example, while we were out there, we investigated both the Spirit Aerospace employees that did the work on the rivets. We don't know who did the work on the door plug. For the Spirit Aerospace employees, we were just informed last week, they're actually not Spirit Aerospace employees, they're contractors. They work for three different contracting firms, Aerotech, Strom Aviation, and Launch. All three of are in the state of Washington. All three people work for three different entities for Spirit Aerospace. Those were not told to us by Spirit Aerospace. That information was told to us through the individuals who were being interviewed that contacted us directly. We have engaged our attorney on this matter, just so you're aware. Boeing has not provided us with the documents and information that we have requested numerous times over the past few months.
That was NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy answering questions from lawmakers in Washington, D.C. Multnomah County Commissioners voted unanimously today to pass a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It was introduced by Commissioner Lori Stegman. A broad coalition first testified on the issue at the beginning of February, and they returned to the county board meeting today to see the ceasefire resolution adopted. It reads in part, quote, "Be it resolved that Multnomah County calls for an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza, an unimpeded entry of humanitarian aid, including food, water, medications, and medical equipment, fuel, restoration of electricity, materials to rebuild housing, and other essential buildings such as hospitals, schools, universities, roads, religious institutions, and all other essentials for human needs," end of quote. More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed in the Israeli onslaught of Gaza since October 7th, and that may be a substantial undercount. In January, the International Court of Justice issued a preliminary ruling saying there was, quote, "a risk of genocide in Gaza," and that Israel must take action to prevent genocide. The siege of Gaza has meant there is virtually no health care or medications available to Palestinians, and infectious diseases are spreading rapidly. Now there is a severe risk of famine, according to international metrics. Gaza is one step below famine in the emergency phase. The ceasefire resolution will now head to Oregon congressional leaders and President Biden. In late January, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek, Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson, and Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler announced the start of a 90-day fentanyl emergency. This week, Vega Peterson led a review of what's happened so far.
Today's briefing is our second briefing on the ongoing 90-day fentanyl emergency, which has been a huge effort by dozens of people in this unified tri-governmental response. Over the last 30 days, 46 people have left or partially left their day jobs to focus on fentanyl across all three governments. That's not to mention the hundreds of outreach workers, case managers, clinicians, first responders, and other staff that have been working before and throughout this emergency. That's significant people resources and a clear demonstration that the governor, the mayor, and our board are treating this as a priority. It's critical to the success of these efforts that while we're working together as a state, city, and county through the unified command structure, we're doing this because it will support our systems-based work. Through this work, we are creating partnership that will help us reduce barriers and sustain this effort for months and years to come. I also want to make it clear that collaboration is not the end game, but where we're beginning in order to make progress during this emergency and beyond. Collaboration is not the outcome. Collaboration is facilitating. The outcome is better responsiveness to hotspots in the areas we're focusing our operations. And it's the long-term plan to sustain this work beyond these first 90 days. Collaboration during this emergency has unlocked and is resulting in real improvements. On day one, we created a collaborative structure. On day 30 and onward, everything that gets achieved is a reflection of that collaboration. One of the most powerful tools in use these past few weeks is a daily rapid response assessment task force. This meeting happens every morning at 8 a.m. with 50 people joining every day. This is where real coordination is happening, where we're making connections for people to find housing, getting people into treatment, moving our outreach teams to the places most needed, and helping to create a continuum of care in real time. In terms of our data efforts and improvements to that process, we knew that data existed, but this is the first time in the history of our work that all agency data is available in one spot and reflects a point in time. This is the collaborative data set our partners and community members have been asking for. I also know the data team is working on following up with requests from commissioners to make sure that we're able to answer all of your questions. We're also seeing good work in putting together a larger policy team that will be working on the longer-term, post-90-day challenges that we'll need to keep accelerating and pressing on as this emergency continues. And we've seen real progress. Off the bat, drug dealer arrests have increased, the fire department has launched an overdose rapid response team, and outreach workers have begun saturating hotspots to help connect people with treatment, recovery, and housing services. We heard this morning from MCSO that there were 3 arrests for distribution of controlled substances just yesterday, 2 in downtown and 1 at 122nd and Burnside. The Burnside arrest involved seizures of 44 fentanyl pills. As we move through this emergency period, we're asking each of our county departments to collaborate and coordinate. Although these 90 days have a focus on our city center, countywide health efforts have been and are ongoing, and we'll be getting an update on some of these specifics today. These efforts will continue to develop best practices around how the work is done in every corner of Multnomah County in service to our entire population.
And that was Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson. As Oregon's current legislative session is about to come to an end, one of the main topics that lawmakers plan to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on is trying to find solutions for the houseless community and to create more affordable housing. Dr. Marisa Sabata studies these issues in the local community.
I run the Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative at Portland State University, and I'm also a professor in urban planning. The issue that we're really facing is the lack of affordable housing. It's really, of course, just an overall issue of the lack of housing in the region. If you look at the state numbers and metro regional government, we are short tens of thousands of units of housing. And that has just created an intractable situation. The data has been consistent around the country. There's a whole book that documents that where we see increases in homelessness, we are seeing increases in rents and decreases in vacancy levels. Basically, the tighter the housing market is, the more likely you're going to see an increase in homelessness. I think the poll question about the idea of, oh, this is taking years to create, it's actually taken decades. And if you really want to go all in, it's the foundation of our country that has led to this moment. And so I think that tied to that then becomes, what is our political will to look at the history of our country and say, we're not going to accept this now. Who are the political leaders who are going to help us take the data and knowledge that we have and actually turn it into action? And so there's both the structural issue of not having enough housing, but then there's the question about community organizing, leadership, and our own willingness to say, no, we're not going to accept the status quo that I think really sits with us.
And that was Portland State University's Dr. Marisa Sabata. A federal court will decide a discrimination case filed against a Montana apartment owner. As Mark Moran reports, it involves accusations of discrimination for physical and psychiatric disabilities.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has charged a Livingston landlord with discrimination after investigating a complaint filed by a former tenant. State housing officials say the nature of the case is unusual and that housing discrimination is on the rise. The HUD complaint charges Livingston-based Yellowstone Apartments and owner Dana Christian with discriminating against a longtime renter for retaliating after the resident's daughter, visiting from Russia, allegedly rebuffed Christian's advances. Montana Fair Housing Executive Director Pam Bean says the renter, a Russian immigrant and U.S. citizen, had never had a problem until she asked the property owner not to approach her daughter.
She'd lived there for 4 years without any notices or violations, and all of a sudden received multiple violations in a few week period, and ultimately moving to evict the complainant.
Bean says the case will be assigned to federal court soon, and the U.S. Department of Justice will represent the renter. Christian did not respond to a request for comment. While cases of housing discrimination are on the increase in Montana as the population grows and property owners are more selective in choosing tenants, Bean says the Yellowstone case is unusual.
In that the defendants seem to just so openly retaliate against the household because it was made clear any type of relationship outside of a business relationship was not something they were interested in.
The HUD charge cites a violation of the Fair Housing Act by unlawfully coercing, intimidating, threatening, or interfering with the tenant's right to complain about unwanted advances made toward her daughter. I'm Mark Moran.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. Then at 5:45, KBOO reporter Isabel Charlet takes a look at local activists calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. At 8, Ear to the Streets kicks off more than 40 hours of special radio programming in honor of International Women's Day. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 29 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, it'll be cloudy, a high of 59. Today in history. On this date in 1878, Alexander Graham Bell was granted a patent for an invention he calls the telephone. The quote of the day is from Italian priest and philosopher Thomas Aquinas, who died this date in 1274. He said, quote, "Sorrow can be alleviated by good sleep, a bath, and a glass of wine." ...2024 frontrunners President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump won big on Super Tuesday. Experts break down what this means. And not everyone in Congress is happy about the budget deals, with the latest on the stories impacting our democracy. Here's 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for God will be with you wherever you go.
Quoting the Book of Joshua, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is ending her presidential campaign. Haley had promised to stay in the race through Super Tuesday, but has been beaten by former President Trump in more than 20 states. Haley has so far refused to endorse the former president. More than half of her voters say they'll support Trump in November, but more than a third of them say they'll back President Joe Biden instead. After his Super Tuesday wins, Trump talked about Biden's handling of the border.
We had the safest border, the best numbers we've ever had, and now we have the worst numbers probably in the history of the world. It's sad to see what's happening to our cities. Our cities are being overrun with migrant crime, and that's Biden migrant crime.
The crime rate is in fact down nationally, and migrants, legal and illegal, are typically more law-abiding than native-born Americans. Voters aren't eager to see a Trump-Biden rematch. A Reuters Ipsos poll finds two-thirds are tired of seeing the same presidential candidates and want someone new. The Biden campaign will focus on the 91 criminal charges Trump faces, but the president may have trouble with his base this fall, given divisions over Gaza policy. Gabriel Sanchez with the Brookings Institute points to the 100,000 people in Michigan and the 50,000 in Minnesota who cast protest votes during the primary.
We did see, unfortunately for the Biden administration, meaningful numbers of voters choose to take this route, which is obviously troubling for the Biden administration, given how tight the race is projected to be.
Friction between the White House and the right-wing government of Israel is increasing and becoming more public. Vice President Kamala Harris is now openly calling for a ceasefire while Israel considers another offensive. The United Nations reports children in northern Gaza are dying from starvation, with some calling the devastation worse than Europe during World War II. Matt Miller is a spokesman with the State Department.
So we believe there ought to be an immediate ceasefire in Gaza that brings the hostages out, that alleviates the suffering of the Palestinian people, and that's what we're advocating for. There is a deal on the table that would deliver all of those things. Hamas just needs to accept it.
Former President Trump is calling for more Israel military action to, as he puts it, finish the problem. Meanwhile, the House has passed $460 billion in spending, enough to keep half of the government open through the fall. But Republicans on the right, flanking both the House and Senate, are unhappy with the budget deals. Utah Senator Mike Lee says the continuing resolutions just add to the huge national debt.
We've gotten real comfortable of whatever your party wants. You make the deal with the other side of the aisle. It's the unholy alliance here. And we merrily and merrily go down the road of stacking up now $1 trillion every 6 months. That's $2 trillion a year.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Washington state lawmakers are getting closer to approving a program that could help 1.2 million workers save for retirement. Eric Tegedoff reports that could help the nearly half of private sector workers who do not have access to retirement savings through their employers.
A program to help Washingtonians automatically save for retirement is in the final stretch in Olympia. The Washington Saves program, created by Senate Bill 6069, passed in both chambers and is awaiting concurrence. It would create an automatic savings program for workers and could benefit about 1.2 million people in the state who currently don't have access to a savings program through their work. Kathy McCall with AARP Washington says many people don't think about savings in their 20s and 30s, but will struggle if they only rely on Social Security when they retire.
If people just save about $1,000 a year and they do that consistently up to the retirement they retire, they financially will be in a great position to actually afford their own retirement.
McCall notes that Social Security provides $1,600 on average per month. She says people are 15 times more likely to save for retirement if money is deducted automatically from their paychecks, like with this program. Washington State's legislative session is scheduled to adjourn today. State Representative Kristen Reeves, a Democrat from Federal Way, was the sponsor of the House version of the Washington Saves bill. She says this program will be a boon for small businesses.
Being able to pick out a retirement package that meets their needs is tough and quite costly if you're a small business owner. And so this is an opportunity for us to help ensure that both small business owners, but the employees of small businesses, are getting access to retirement security from the first day they start working.
A lack of savings will cost the state nearly $4 billion by 2040, according to research from the Pew Charitable Trust. John Scott is the director of the Retirement Savings Project with Pew.
When people don't save enough for retirement, some of those folks will need some help in old age. And so they will turn to social assistance like Medicaid. And so anything we can do to help folks be prepared for retirement means that it'll be less of a fiscal concern for taxpayers in the state.
15 states already have similar savings programs in place, including California and Washington. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A federal court will decide a discrimination case filed against a Montana apartment owner. As Mark Moran reports, it involves accusations of discrimination for physical and psychiatric disabilities.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has charged a Livingston landlord with discrimination after investigating a complaint filed by a former tenant. State housing officials say the nature of the case is unusual and that housing discrimination is on the rise. The HUD complaint charges Livingston-based Yellowstone Apartments and owner Dana Christian with discriminating against a longtime renter for retaliating after the resident's daughter, visiting from Russia, allegedly rebuffed Christian's advances. Montana Fair Housing Executive Director Pam Bean says the renter, a Russian immigrant and U.S. citizen, had never had a problem until she asked the property owner not to approach her daughter.
She'd lived there for 4 years without any notices or violations, and all of a sudden
received multiple violations in a few week period and ultimately moving to evict the complainant.
Bean says the case will be assigned to federal court soon and the U.S. Department of Justice will represent the renter. Christian did not respond to a request for comment. While cases of housing discrimination are on the increase in Montana as the population grows and property owners are more selective in choosing tenants, Bean says the Yellowstone case is unusual.
In that the defendants seem to just so openly retaliate against the household because it was made clear any type of relationship outside of a business relationship was not something they were interested in.
The HUD charge cites a violation of the Fair Housing Act by unlawfully coercing, intimidating, threatening, or interfering with the tenant's right to complain about unwanted advances made toward her daughter. I'm Mark Moran.
A new art exhibition is currently on display at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art. It's called Policing Justice, and it boldly confronts the nationwide problem of police violence and ongoing community demands for accountability. KABU reporter Sam Bowman and Jasmine spoke with co-curator Nina Amstutz and contributor Max Smith about their roles in bringing this exhibition to life and their perspectives on the intersection of art, activism, and community empowerment.
We spoke with Amstutz and Smith for about 30 minutes. You can find that full interview on the evening news page at kabu.fm. Definitely check it out. But for now, we'd like to focus on the events that are happening in the next couple of days as part of the larger Policing Justice Project, which includes a multimedia art installation, a symposium focused on Portland's past, present, and future police reform movements, and a series of films, among other media and events. Check out the full list at PICA.org. That's PICA.org.
The film series opens tonight at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater with the feature Reimagining Safety and the short film Is Portland Dying?, followed by a Q&A with directors Matthew Solomon and Corey Elia, respectively, and moderated by Alex Vitale. This weekend, there is a symposium, Policing in Portland, a Community Conversation, which includes an opening lecture by Alex Vitale on Friday at Portland State, and three panel discussions on Saturday at PICA, one of which is moderated by Max Smith.
We're looking at the history of policing in Portland first, and we'll be meeting with a number of people, including former Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, Dr. Juniper Simonis, who obviously has done a ton of the tear gas research here in Portland, Ryan Dundon, Carissa Dez, Robert Mackey, and we'll be really discussing what has already occurred, right? So really kind of trying to build a base of all the reasons that people were in the streets, are still in the streets to a degree, all the reasons that people are really frustrated with the policing in this city. Beyond George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, there's been so much history just here. The second panel is going to be around police reform and accountability, which will probably be a bit of a more broad conversation than just reform and a bit and accountability. But it's really important, to separate from what has already happened and what has already not been accounted for, to discuss what accountability should look like, and also just all the ways in which we are not there yet. And then the third panel is going to be really about stepping forward and reimagining safety. So we have Amber Boydston from Spirit of Justice is going to be hosting that one with Tristan Edwards, Sterling Cuneo, and Sarah Tia Mead. Chris Ryder's a great educator, as well as Kay and Salton Davis, who is one of our artists. So, because people always ask, so if there's not police, what's going to happen, right? Who's going to save my grandma if someone's breaking in her house? This gives us some of those tangible answers to what that can and should look like, or looks like in other places where we don't have these militarized police forces, related to just having that discussion.
As we said, the symposium includes a keynote talk tomorrow night, Friday, March 8th, at PSU's Shattuck Hall Annex. Here's Nina Amstutz.
Yes, the opening lecture by Alex Vitale will be at Portland State University, just so we can have a bigger room in Shattuck Hall, and that's at 6 p.m. on Friday. And I think this is a really great way to open the symposium, and that Alex is a national policing scholar. He wrote the book The End of Policing, which has been viewed or called the Bible of the Defund the Police movement. And he will be speaking both to the national movements toward police accountability that have come out of 2020, in addition to the local context. And so it'll provide a kind of really nice framework, I think, for the discussions on Saturday in the panels.
The series of films also begins very soon, tonight, again, at the Clinton Street Theater. Here's Amstutz.
Our film series kicks off with the Portland premiere of the film Reimagining Safety by the director Matthew Solomon, as well as a short by Corey Alaya called Is Portland Dying? And so that's a multi-episode series that he's created, and he'll be airing episode one, which specifically has to do with policing in Portland. And so the directors will both be at the Clinton Street Theater, which is where our film series takes place. The films start at 7 p.m. And there'll be a Q&A moderated by Alex Vitale, again, our keynote speaker for the symposium as well, who is also in the film Reimagining Safety. And so that's a great kickoff. If you are available tonight, come on out.
That was Nina Amstutz, Associate Professor of Art and Architecture at the University of Oregon and one of the curators of the Policing Justice Program at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. We also talked to Max Smith, a journalist, contributor, and moderator with the Policing Justice Project. Again, you can find the full version of this conversation on the evening news page at kbu.fm.
For the evening news, this is Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet, Sam Bowman, Mel Gertoff, and Jasmine. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO